It's hard to believe that it's been over 20 years since a television series Band of Brothers came out, but I think we'd all agree it remains hugely influential in popular culture as a representation of the World War II experience. And one of the most powerful episodes of that series was Episode 9, Why We Fight, the episode where Easy Company liberates a concentration camp. I am super happy to have been able to talk to John Orloff, who wrote the episode, and to Ross McCall, the actor who played Joe Liebgott, a Jewish soldier. I am certain you're going to enjoy seeing behind the scenes as much as I did, and for those that are wondering, yes, we did talk a little about Masters of the Air, which John also wrote and produced. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Holocaust History Podcast. I'm your host, Waitman Bourne. And today we have an episode that I've been wanting to do since the beginning of the podcast. Because as I said in my introduction, which most people probably haven't listened to, I like to cover the Holocaust from a variety of perspectives, not just academic, but also popular and cultural. And so today I'm very, very excited to have on the podcast John Orloff and Ross McCall, in this case from Band of Brothers. They're also from other things as well. And we're going to be talking about episode 9 of that particular series, which part of the episode involved the liberation of a concentration camp. And I'm just super excited to hear about both the writing for and the process of filming that particular event, because I watched it again last night, and you know, it sounds like a very sort of silly question, but I kept thinking as I'm watching it, what is it like to be walking around that particular set, doing that particular job? So, John, Ross, welcome. How you doing?
Good, thanks. That's a Ross question. I never walked around the set.
Oh, this is true. Well, that's it. This is another question too, because one of the things that I was wondering was, you know, where does the writing stop and the directing pick up in terms of, you know, how this particular event is portrayed. But before we get, let's maybe start at the very beginning. John, can you tell us, because you actually wrote, I would argue, I mean, I'm partially biased, but two of the most important episodes, right? The Day of Days, which is the actual drop on Normandy and all of that, but also this one. So yeah. how did you get involved in writing this episode in particular?
I got really, really lucky. I in the late 90s, I had written a script on spec about the Shakespeare authorship question of all things. Who wrote the Shakespeare plays? And I bet you didn't think that would come up in this conversation. And
I was hoping.
And Tom Hanks had read the script, didn't want to make it, but had me come in to meet with him about maybe writing a different movie for Tom. And I had heard about Band of Brothers, that he was making it. And I was a huge history buff, a huge World War II buff. And I just asked him point blank, hey, do you need writers for Band of Brothers? If you do, I'd love to throw my hat in the ring. And Tom was like, no, we're just going to have this one guy, Eric Jenderson, write the whole thing, but thanks for your interest. And we went on talking about other stuff. And then a couple months go by and another meeting happens. And Tom, just out of the blue, just says, hey, are you still interested in writing for Band of Brothers? And I go, yes. And he goes, hey, well, you want to write the D-Day episode? And I'm like, okay. And that was about, that was in 99, I want to say. So it was only like 2 or 3 years after Saving Private Ryan had been made, which totally changed the face of how we understand World War II as an audience. It's hard if you're a certain age, say my age, to know the difference of how war movies, but in particular World War II movies, were portrayed before Saving Private Ryan as opposed to after Saving Private Ryan. But that D-Day sequence is just amazing. Anyway, So I wrote that episode, went in for my notes meeting. He had very, very little notes. And he just said, "That's great. You want to write another one?" I'm like, okay. "You want to write the concentration camp episode?" Okay. So I that's how I got it. And I went home and so
it was called the concentration camp episode.
Yeah. And I think Tom thought I was Jewish when he asked me that, which is not a crazy thing to assume, but I'm not. So I always thought that was kind of funny. In any event, yeah, that's how I got it.
And so it comes in a particularly interesting moment in the series. One of the things I kept picking up on, right, which is, you know, I don't have to be the New York Times film critic to pick it up, but you know that people are starting to question, you know, what are we doing? Why are we here? In a kind of much more theoretical way. I mean, because they obviously know why they're fighting, but there seems to be more of a need for a reason beyond just that the Nazis are sort of imperialistic conquerors, right?
Right.
So how does this – what is the role of this episode, I guess, in the overall arc of the series? Or what was it supposed to be?
Well, I think it was supposed to be, and it is. I mean, it's literally answered by the title of the episode, Why We Fight, which is a callback to the Frank Capra movies made during the war. And it was, I mean, it was intended to be exactly what it is, sort of a tone poem about why all these men had suffered all these dreadful things in this war and made all these sacrifices. And yeah, I think in some ways it's the heart of the show. In some ways, you know, I mean, the show is about so many things, but I think it's a gut punch, this episode, you know?
I mean, I think, and I, you know, I like the way that it's, and again, this is a question, right? Is when does the writing stop and the directing begin, right? But you probably wrote this as well, you know, the way that it's when the camp is discovered, we don't really see it. You know, the next thing you see is Brigante running, right?
Yeah.
You know, it was always, running back and trying to figure out.
That is a mixture of decent writing and really good directing. I mean, I think we were really lucky with our director on this episode. It was like the right writer, the right director for this particular episode. He had family who had perished in the Holocaust, like close family, like uncles, I think, his father's brothers. And so he was really rooted to the material in a really deep way, which I think really helped. But Ross can talk more about that because I, other than a few phone calls, I was never on set. So, and my first draft was pretty close to the shooting draft of that episode. So there weren't a lot of director notes. There were a couple, he even tweaked a scene or two himself, which worked out really, really well, changing some dialogue. But there was not a lot of collaboration between me and the director on this episode, because everybody was pretty darn happy with the first draft.
When you were writing it, what were the challenges to it? I mean, were there things that you were trying to avoid or cliches that you're trying to avoid?
You know, you always, I mean, this was a very hard episode, I think, in terms of just the whole show. It was a different episode because there wasn't a lot of information about it. You know, even the book Band of Brothers, there's only about a paragraph of them discovering the camp. So there weren't a lot of nuts and bolts of, well, what did you do while you were there? You know, who did you talk to? There was none of that. And when I called up the men, so initially when they said, you know, do you want to do the concentration camp episode? It's very briefly mentioned in the book. It's very briefly mentioned in Eric Jenderson's Bible. The reason being, I soon discovered was the men didn't want to talk about it to Stephen Ambrose or to me. So when I called up the guys that I had gotten to know writing episode two, particularly those guys, you know, that were at Breakhorn Manor, I had a better rapport with because I'd already interviewed them quite a bit. So Malarkey, Lipton, Compton, Winters, who else? Anyway, whatever. And so I went to those guys and said, "Hey, what do you remember about this camp?" And basically, all of them said, "I don't want to talk about it." Like they just literally did not even want to have a conversation about anything, except for Dick Winters, who talked to me a little bit about it. But interestingly, their memories were very vague, it was very different than talking to them about Breakhorn Manor or when the other writers would talk to them about Bastogne or so it was actually quite difficult. And I would say in the show, it's one of the episodes that leans the most on drama over reality.
Right.
Because we don't entirely know what really happened. And what we do know actually is different than what we show in the episode. In actual fact, Easy Company did not discover this sub camp. But here's what's interesting. They thought they did in 1999. So remember, in 1999, there's no internet, right? I mean, or there's just the basic, but you can't check anything on the internet. You can't go, who discovered Camp 4? You can't do that. So all we had was the guys, right? Like, and if a guy tells you, if Lipton says, "Yeah, I remember when we liberated that camp. It's too hard for me to talk about." You believe him, right? So we didn't know for years and years and years until after Band was made that Easy Company was not the first unit in. Because the experience was so enormous on these guys that it felt like to them they were the first people in. Because I think in their memories, they couldn't remember what day they were in that camp. All they could remember is they went into that camp, and I guess it was the next day. So it was still incredibly fresh, and as we know, the prisoners were still in the camp. So for them, the experience was just as though they had discovered the camp, because in their memories, they did.
Also one of the really interesting things about the liberation phenomenon in general, right, which is that, for example, Dachau, you have like, you know, several different units claiming they liberated
part
it.
Part of Dachau.
The liberation of the main camp at Dachau.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You have several different divisions claiming to be the liberators based on whether it was their reconnaissance jeep that pulled up first or whether they were there, you know, dealing with the aftermath. You know, and so this idea of who is a liberator in general, right, is this kind of fraught.
Well, I think you have
category.
To lean in a little bit to what John was saying there too. The men back at that time, regardless, would have walked into that first-hand experience not knowing what this thing was.
Yeah.
Not knowing who was in there, what it was about. So to them at that particular time, it is the first time they're ever seeing it, the first time it's ever getting talked about. So, yeah, I mean, I go to Dachau maybe three times a year, and like each time you do go there, there are different stories. But the truth is, everybody had their liberation story. You know, everybody had that moment of walking in and going, "What the hell is this?"
Well, it bears mentioning, you know, probably, I mean, you guys probably know, but for the listeners, you know, that only very rarely, if ever, were American units tasked with liberating camps. Mm-hmm. So they rarely ever got the orders, you know, advanced to this location. And so they just came across whatever happened to be in their sector were going. And so, yeah, so they had, you know, literally no idea that they were even going to come across a camp, much less what the conditions were like within it, right?
But also, also have to remember the amount of camps that were being found as well were hundreds to thousands. I mean, these things were popping up left, right, and center. Landsberg, which we, you know, talk about in the show, that was a sub-camp of, I think there were five different versions of you know, the Landsberg borough, I guess.
Right.
So it was like this just insane amount. But again, pre you know, pre-technology, you would have no way of knowing that that's happening down here and that's happening here until after you've discovered.
I mean, yeah, this is the worm's eye view of war, right? I mean, like I always tell people, you know, like if you want to know what happened in the Iraq War, don't ask me. I was just a platoon leader. Like I have no idea beyond my very small part of the world,
right,
you know,
right.
what happened. And probably, you know, if someone were to interview me many years from now, there's lots of things I've incorporated into my memory that places I was that I may not have been at the same time or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know,
that happens a lot in band too, you know, talking to the guys and, you know, here the story becomes more real than the reality.
Yeah. But then again, sometimes there's, you know, like Tim O'Brien, the famous author of Vietnam, you know, said that sort of he was writing about, you know, when is a war story true? And this idea mm-hmm. of truth can also be fiction in a certain yeah. sense. You know, there is an historical truth that's factual, but then there's also an historical truth, what the kids these days would call vibes, you know, like sort of like the feeling and the, you know, the way that something appears. And it was interesting because you mentioned the interviews with the veterans, because when I was watching it again last night, in the beginning of the episode, usually right in the beginning of the episode, it's kind of a teaser of like what you're going to be seeing in the episode, right? But in the beginning of this episode, and I don't know if you chose the interviews or not, but they were all basically, it was really interesting to me as somebody that wrote a book about how the Wehrmacht was deeply complicit in the Holocaust, that the interview at the beginning was basically, well, these guys are just like us.
Right.
And we sort of felt a kinship in a certain way with the Germans.
Well, that is obviously true, you
yeah.
know, and that was, those interviews were picked way later
okay.
after the show was edited and not by me, I think by Tom, quite frankly. He was really involved with the interviews. And anyway, they didn't talk about Landsberg in those interviews, really, if at all. And B, the thematic... What was interesting about this episode is it gave me an opportunity as a writer to open things up thematically, to have a larger tableau of issues to talk about. And so for me, what you just brought up was really interesting, right? Like we went into Germany after being in England and France and the Netherlands, and the guys were actually not that comfortable in England, France, or the Netherlands. It was Europe. These guys were farm boys from Pennsylvania. And at that point in particular, Europe was really Europe. And the cultures were very, very different. They hadn't been Americanized by us. And so they were really uncomfortable in England and France in terms of just dealing with the regular people. The culture was so different. They get to Germany, and man, it is a middle-class society, very similar to America in a lot of ways. And they were really comforted by that, you know? And they had those feelings of, yeah, I could go hunting with that guy, you know? I could. And then they discover something that makes them understand, no, this society is very, very different. But it is also a lens into, well, Nazis don't always look like Nazis. You know, bad people don't always look like bad people. And the universality of the banality of evil, you know, is sort of one of the things that I think the episode touches upon, you know, with the baker and the housewife and...
Well, this is a question that I wanted to add, and I promise we're gonna get to Ross because I want to hear about, you know, what
it
was like
fascinated
on the set.
By this.
But one of the things that I picked up on again is this idea of criminality.
Yep,
in the
absolutely.
Episode. And at the very beginning,
read.
You know, until we get to the camp, we're witnessing
spears.
Lots
spears.
Of different kinds of criminality, right? We have spears.
Yep.
We have Nixon, you know, just breaking in. But we also
yep.
have the French soldiers
yep.
executing.
Yep. Being executed.
Germans.
Executed.
And so it's almost like there's an idea
totally,
that,
100%.
You know, you're introducing different kinds of criminality, but then you're also saying, hey, wait a second, there's a different kind.
Exactly.
As well.
There are gradations of there's a lot of gray in the episode of behavior and what does war do to a person and what kind of crimes, petty crimes, does war already sort of create, right? Just in the world of war, you know, you are forced to make those decisions and they're bad, right? Like we can all, you know, talk about, you know, the My Lai massacre or, you know, things where American troops have done bad things. But there's bad and then there's really bad, you know, and I think that's absolutely 100% in baked into the script.
Yeah. And then there's that, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, again, but there's that great moment that it sort of bookends the episode, right, where Nixon is sort of looting the house and the woman comes out, her husband's clearly been killed. And, you know, you feel kind of like, ooh. And Nixon feels like this. It seems like, you know, that he's intruded on the situation. He kind of gets caught doing a bad thing and he kind of leaves, you know, and the dog is barking at him. And for some reason, I picked up on that last night. You know, the dog is also like sort of condemning him. But then when we get to the end
dog,
of it.
And remember, his wife has taken
the dog.
Oh,
took the dog. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but then we get to the end. And again, it all kinds of, you have this emotional switch in the viewer, which is, oh, yeah, screw that lady. You know,
Who
don't
has
feel
the
bad
moral
at all
high
for her,
ground
like,
now? You know,
yeah,
yeah. All of that is intentional. All of that is in there for a reason. Interestingly, the house thing is true, but it happened to Dick Winters. He went into a German widow's house and started to just sort of make himself at home. And then this woman walked in and without saying anything, Winters left. And it's like, okay, I am not welcome here. And I then transposed that to Nixon because I had decided weeks earlier that the episode should be about Nixon. We got to kind of choose our, you know, nobody was telling us what to write. So, you know, I was like, okay, I'm doing the concentration camp episode. None of the guys will talk to me about it. Who's this episode about and what's the journey? You know, and Ron had been doing such amazing work next to the great Ross McCall that it's like, you know, maybe Nixon is a really interesting way into this episode.
Well, it's a great example. If there's sort of a keyword, one of the keywords I think is perspective in mm-hmm. the episode, right? Because on the one hand, you have this perspective on criminality and what's really bad criminality and what's just sort of, which again gives us this perspective, sort of the creeping overall criminality of war itself and the fact that war itself tends to degrade our moral, you know, boundaries. But then you also have, you know, it sounds kind of cruel, I suppose, but it puts his life in perspective too. You know, like he's upset that his wife's leaving him, which is awful, and taking the dog, and he can't find, you know, VAT 69 that he likes, but then there's also the camp, you know,
right.
and are my issues as bad as sort of larger issues that we're discovering, you know, in the series.
Yeah, right. As you said, it's a matter of perspective, right?
So speaking of perspective, see, this is why I can do this transitions. What's it like? And this is such a dumb question, but it's like the question at the heart of this whole thing, Ross, is like, what is it like to walk into a concentration camp? I mean, because essentially the actors in this episode really are the only ones that have done this. Obviously, it's not a real thing, and obviously it's not 100% realistic in that sense, but really you're the only ones that have done this since the people did it back in 1945. I mean, because obviously, and for good reason, this is not something that we recreate, you know, to experience. But there's a justification for you guys re-experiencing it because you were filming it. So, I mean,
Let me start by saying, I think when you ask most people who have watched Band of Brothers, but there's a high percentage tend to pick out two episodes of the show. It tends to be episode 7 and episode 9. Tend to be the ones that I hear from most people are, you know, the most engaging, emotional, heartbreaking, heart-rendering.
Seven's best,
real.
It's the second best.
Like the one where things really get bad.
Yes. It's when Spears does the run.
Yeah. Spears and Lipton are running the show, and Spears, yes, goes over.
But can I interrupt Ross just one sec? Because that is my favorite moment in the show, and I did not write it. When Spears runs.
Oh, it's magical. It's a magical moment in the show.
It's like the epitome of Band of Brothers.
My point of bringing that up is both episodes are directed by David Frankel. And David had a knack of, and he did 9 first and then 7, so we shot out of order, but had a knack of just sort of understanding really what that heartbeat of that particular episode was. And the thing that I've always said about episode 9, which just stems from the great John Orloff's writing, it's handled so gracefully in a sense of, it's gratuitous in many ways, and it's heartbreaking, but it's dealt in such a, it's strange to say the word, but John wrote it with such a kindness, in a sense, that when you sit down, you can't help but totally just be, you give into the episode. You just say, I'm here. You don't actually get to the camp until probably about the second act, maybe even the third. It's later on, because we're dealing with Nixon, we're dealing with the men. You're talking about various different moments of criminality. I mean, I think there's a part where I had decided to smile at the French guys getting executed, and that's a soldier's headspace, and it's like, where's that? And then it's funny looking back on it now, I'm goofing around talking about, Flash Gordon and God knows what, and all these things are happening within that episode between the men, for them to come across this monstrosity. Yeah, it was a very clever move. The producers had spoken to me early on. I knew that I was going to have a pivotal role in the ep. I knew that 8, 9, and 10 were primarily Liebgott's, like, big, big, strong episodes, even though he's in every other one.
Because for those who were listening, it may not have picked up on this, Ross played Joe Liebgott, who was a Jewish-American soldier, so that's why.
Right. Yeah. And I knew I had to speak and translate a lot of German within this as well. So, yeah, I'm doing an American accent. And, speaking German with that accent and trying to figure out what, so it was a, it was a great piece for myself. But we discussed whether or not I should go and visit one of the memorial sites beforehand. And mutually decided, but I felt very strongly about it, was that I wanted to see what the men saw as close to that as possible. So I probably want to hold off going to a memorial site and see this for the first time on camera. That was my adventure. I know a lot of the other guys had their own ways of doing that and whatever, but mine was, I want to be. Also, when you first see Liebgott, you see he's back at the trucks. He's hanging back. I think I'm just smoking a cigarette with somebody. I'm not involved in it until, Lipton brings him in and calls him in to translate. Seeing it, Hatfield was where we shot the majority of the show, a little bit out in the countryside sometimes and some in Switzerland, but the majority was all shot in this old disused airbase that, we would build the town of Carentan, and then you'd cross a bridge and you'd be in Eindhoven, and then you'd cross another bridge and they'd demolish that, and then they'd, build another town for us for the next episode. And this was deep in the forest of Hatfield. So it was a good kind of mile trek on a deuce and a half to get out there. And the day they took us out, and again, it was offered, do you want to go see the set? And we said, no, I think we'll wait until the moment. And when you get there, you are, again, dealing with the highest echelon of greats within our industry. So that boils down to your costumers, to your set design, to everything is just the best of the best. And we showed up, and there was Landsberg. There were cadavers everywhere. There were background artists that they had brought in who were pretty emaciated anyway. That was aided with some makeup. That was aided with a tiny little bit of CGI on certain moments. That was there was an animatronic at one point, the old gentleman in his son's arms, is an animatronic being controlled off screen to make him twitch. But we were just surrounded by, and it was burning embers. It was horrific. It did what it was supposed to do. And I remember all of us. And you've got to bear in mind, listen, Band of Brothers is an elite show in the sense of that trauma bonding that put maybe the 10 main of us through boot camp really solidified that brotherhood. And so there was a lot of goofing around on Band. Everybody knew also, how to take it seriously.
You by that point, you'd been working on the show for, what, 8 months?
Yeah, it'd been a while. I mean, we shot it just, yeah. I mean, we were.
My point is, it's not like a normal movie where you're on it for 8 weeks.
100%. We knew everything. We knew how to, I mean, we could, you know, goof around because we knew as soon as action was called, we were in, we were soldering, we knew how to reload. We knew everything. You know, we knew how to do what we needed to do. We knew how to soldier. And so this immediately, as you can imagine, just stopped everything. And it stopped everything in a way of, we were only in the camp, I don't remember the exact amount of days, but it was maybe only 4 or 5 days. We weren't there shooting for a long time, but those 4 or 5 days were extremely solemn, extremely respectful in many ways because we're on a Hollywood movie set, but it felt like we were absolutely in a concentration camp. Turrets, towers, barbed wire, chain link fences, guards, not guards, sorry, prisoners, just fire pits to huts to, I mean, just unspeakable and unfathomable things. And you had to shoot a show within this every day, you know, and there's a train carriage at the bottom full of cadavers, just bodies upon bodies upon bodies. And it was just a horrific sight. But what I do say, and again, it goes back to John's writing, and it goes back to David's directing, was it was handled with such grace. You know, I don't think there's anything else that you can watch that's quite like that episode in Band of Brothers. Other concentration Holocaust movies are, you know, heartbreakingly real and terrifying and all that, but Band deals with it in such a incredibly gentle way in many ways, so anybody can sit down and watch it, you know, and really.
One of the things that I actually really am really proud of is, you know, you've already mentioned it, that you know, the first half of the episode kind of takes you off your guard as a viewer. You know, you get sucked into this psychodrama of Nixon's. It's kind of funny a little bit. There's a little more dark humor in the first 20 pages, and you don't know what's about to happen as an audience member any more than the guys do, because you don't know this is the concentration camp episode going into episode 9, and you still don't for 20 minutes. And so when it hits you, it's a sucker punch. I always say it's a sucker punch. And the other thing that sort of ancillary of that is when you sit down to watch Schindler's List, you've made a commitment to watch a Holocaust movie, and your head is in the right frame of mind, and you sit down and you go, okay, this is going to be a tough couple of hours. And, you know, but when you sit down to watch Band of Brothers, you have not signed up for a concentration camp movie, you know? And so a huge amount of people are going to learn about the Holocaust not expecting to learn about the Holocaust.
Unknowingly, yes. Absolutely.
Unknowingly. And I think it works really, really, really well on that level.
That's a much nicer way of putting it than me skirting around. It really
no,
is.
No,
like
no, no. We're just saying
different
things. We're pointing out different things.
Well,
you
I
know?
Think one of the things that's really beneficial is the history. That it's not Dachau, it's not Auschwitz, right? It's and again, this is a Holocaust historian saying this. You know, comparatively, it's not necessarily the worst place in the Holocaust, right?
It's not
but
even
it's obviously horrendous, and I think that actually makes it more powerful, and I think speaks to what you've both talked about in terms of, I think in some ways, maybe what Ross was trying to say in a sense was that it's a little bit understated, but in an appropriate way.
Right.
You know, you don't have like gratuitous sort of, there's no Nazis there, you know, there's no violence that takes place
But it's also the same as what John was alluding to there. It's like, you know, when you sit down to watch Schindler's List, that's where you're at.
Yeah.
And I think what band or that episode did so beautifully was, you know, it's one of the greatest teachings of the Holocaust in many ways, because you're not jumping in to go, okay, here we go. You're watching something else, and then it hits you the way that it was hitting the men. And all of a sudden now you're going, oh, my Lord. And, you know, you're in it now. And there's no way.
In some ways, it's a more visceral. It's a really visceral
100%.
Audience reaction, because for the reasons we just said, right? You did not walk into the theater planning to do this, and the way the episode unfolds is a gut punch. You know.
Well, and I think you see that in a way that you don't necessarily see in other shows. I mean, I felt like when I'm watching this episode, that a lot of the actors aren't acting in the sense that, like, I mean, you know, they really are feeling stunned and overwhelmed.
Well,
and I imagine in my imagination, if there's a break in filming, everyone's just kind of standing around. They're not like, whereas in a different episode, they might be, as Ross mentioned, like, you know, smoking and joking. And in my imagination, this episode, if there's a pause in filming or directing, they're just kind of like, at least in the first day, maybe just kind of walking around.
The first few days, it was absolutely that. It was mourning. Yeah. It was, you were literally, you would sit down and you would be mourning. You would just be, this is unreal what I'm seeing. And so, look, there was a trick there, because we are all relatively well educated on the Holocaust. You know, my studies into Liebgott, into his faith, and into that world of Joe, I really wanted to delve deeper into the Holocaust for that reason, and, you know, found out even more shocking things. But still, you're going in with a knowledge. And so you had to turn that knowledge off, because you had to come across like, I feel terrible for this person, but I have no idea why he's here. I'm looking at him and he looks awful. I don't understand. So what is this? You know, tapping into that was the beauty of the writing and the directing, was being able to.
Yeah. And how did you decide to play Liebgott the way you did? Because another way of playing it, which I think actually would not be as good, you know, is sort of the angry, avenging Jewish soldier, sort of, which you don't do. I mean, that would be sort of, to me, like the C+, you know, amateur actor. It is like, I'm going to be, you know, super angry and sort of vengeful, but you don't choose that. You choose something different.
I wanted to humanize him. And for me, you know, John mentioned earlier, these were kids. They were kids, you know, from a different part of the world. And this was so unheard of. You also want to give, you know, I hate talking about such a serious subject matter and then talking about, you know, the methods of our acting and what, you know, but the truth is there's an arc and you have to have an arc. And Liebgott finds that anger in episode 10. You know, that's where that comes again, you know, but yeah, playing that same beat over and over is not going to be, you know, it is not going to find the emotions that I wanted to convey. And what I wanted to convey was the everyman of going, this is just, not only is this horrific, it's also personal. And why is it personal? Like, how can that be? How can this be? You know, anyway.
And did you guys have to process this? You know, when you're, I don't know what the routine is, you know, for being a big time actor. I don't know if you go sort of hang out after filming or whatever, but you know, was this a situation where you sort of had to, like, you sat down and thought with each other or talked with each other, you know, gosh, like, what was that like? You know, this was amazing or this was terrible, or how are you dealing with this?
Yeah. I mean, of course there was moments that, I mean, again, we had read the script. We had a table read. I don't know if you were there or not, John. I can't remember. You weren't.
Nope.
And we did a table read in one of the tents, you know, one of our dressing tents. And we all said that, so we knew what was coming on paper.
Yeah,
you know, on paper, we knew what was coming, and so that a lot of those conversations were perhaps happening beforehand because we were also in research mode. You know, so I mean, I was inundated with, you know, facts and you know, horrible things that we had to talk about and deal with and whatever, that was already there. So by the time when we got to work, you know, it was about, okay, how do we tell this story in the best way possible to honor the script that we've been given and to honor the direction of someone like David, who had such a personal investment in this himself, you know. I know he had a hard time when we were shooting because it was so real.
I mean, that's one of the things that, again, watching it and realizing on the one hand that these are other people, like normal people who are portraying, for example, concentration camp inmates. Mm. I mean, imagine that, you know, they're extras or whatnot. But I mean, even for them, it must have been like a very, what an amazingly difficult and complex role to play, even if it's a non-speaking sort of inmate role.
Well, that's something that the producers of the show, I've always said, was a genius stroke. You know, the fact that you have Tom, you have Steve, and we had Tony Toe, who's our boots on the ground producer at that point, you know, Meg Lieberman, who cast it, and Captain Dye, who was our military advisor, him and the cadre. I've always said that that group of people, by putting us in a boot camp, by you know, keeping us all away from our trailers and hanging out together in between setups and in between and kind of living together for a year, that really created such a bond between the majority of the men. You know, obviously there's different sections of that. You know, there's like 10 of us, and then there's maybe another 30 around that and another 50 around that. But, you know, everybody was close. But what they did was I never saw a German soldier the entire time until we were like shooting. I never saw a prisoner until we were there. We never saw anything outside of what we were supposed to be doing. I rarely saw, you know, the members of the public, like until we were shooting at the beginning of episode 9. So it was a very clever way of just keeping everything separate. So everybody going in, and again, I can't answer for the folks that came in and played the prisoners, because I have no idea what they'd be going through, but I'm sure it was a big conversation, you know. But everybody was kept apart until the cameras were rolling.
And I think this is one of the interesting things. Again, we talked a lot about reactions, whether it's the actors reacting to the scene that they're portraying or the actual soldiers themselves. And I think maybe, John, you can speak to this a little bit. The way that you wrote O'Keefe's character into this episode, mm-hmm. right? Because he's the new guy. The FNG, we would say, right, who shows up and, like, nobody gives him the time of day, though, who's it? Is it Lutz?
It's Percanti.
Kind of is nice to him a little bit, right?
Oh,
but, yeah. You know,
it's Percanti, but he's kind of the new guy with no... really hard... It's Percanti who keeps not saying
that's right.
his name right.
Yeah, the guy who is, he's at the 30 cal...
OP. Yeah, he's at the OP and...
And he gets sort of a hard time, but it's almost like... Maybe this is just me looking at it, but it's almost like he becomes a veteran.
Oh, completely.
At the camp.
Completely. And that guy's real. O'Keefe is a real guy. And one of the few guys who would talk to me about Landsberg, because he hadn't been so bruised by Bath Stone. He came in after Bath Stone as a soldier in Easy Company. And so he didn't have those horrible, horrible combat experiences that the other guys did. So he was razzed a little bit. I might have made that bigger than it was. I can't remember exactly how much he was razzed. But I'm pretty sure it was my idea to keep on calling him different names until the very end of the episode when Percanti calls him O'Keefe. For the whole episode, he's called him different things, O'Brien, oh this, oh that. And then after the camps, they call him O'Keefe. Because, yeah, he had his own combat experience without combat, you know. And he was one of the guys now, in a superficial way, at least. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, I think it's more than superficial, right? Because one of the themes throughout Band of Brothers is this rites of passage theme.
Yeah.
Right? Like what, like, were you there
yeah,
for
but you were a
Tekoa
guy
were
you
there
or you
for...
weren't. That, yeah. There's always going to be, if you were a Tekoa guy.
Right. Even not. Webster gets that when he comes back, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he's not.
That still happens in real life. If they didn't go to boot camp, there's a thing. You know, that's still like.
But I think that it's interesting that, you know, we talk about moral injury as a thing that soldiers often encounter, right? Which obviously happens in World War II. We don't have the words for it. You know, but in that sense, it is sort of like a psychological combat that O'Keefe is experiencing. And he, without putting too fine a point on it, it's almost like he grows up, you know, exponentially years in that, because he's even sitting like a soldier would be sitting after combat, you know, with the helmet off, you know, kind of sitting on the hill there. But obviously he hasn't fired his weapon, but
and remember, he's also key in that beat you both have brought up, when the French soldiers execute the POWs. That's really playing off of O'Keefe horrified and Liebgott and whoever else is sitting next to him just shrugging it off. You know, the beat only works if both of those exist, right? If O'Keefe's naivete is counterpointed by Liebgott's sort of brushing it off as just another day at the office.
Yeah, I mean, I think it works really well there because it took me a couple watchings to pick up on the, you know, there's crime of varying amounts continuing, you know, throughout the episode, but then, you know, you get to the camp period and there's clearly, you know, this is clearly worse, right? You know, and one of the things that I think I have a question about, you know, that with regard to Nixon, because one of the things I hadn't picked up on, you know, in his detail the first couple of times, you know, many years ago when I watched it, is that they only go to the camp that one time, right? And then they hand it over to the armored division to take care of it. But actually, then you have to ask the question, well, how does Nixon get back there? And it's because he intentionally makes an effort to go back and see it again. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that choice. You know, why do you have him do that?
Well, from his perspective or my perspective? From my perspective, he goes back because I want to finish the note of the public culpability.
Yeah.
In all of this, right? The German culpability.
He becomes the witness for that.
He becomes the witness of the housewife who shamed him, right? He then becomes a witness to her being shamed. You know, the reverse of that moment in the house is the moment in the camp where she's burying the bodies and she looks up and she sees the guy that had, you know, so rudely invited himself into her house. And so that payoff was there. And I wanted to, as somebody who was just writing the script, I wanted to show the relationship between the villages and the camp. You know, that's why there's the whole Baker beat, you know, how could you not know? Didn't you smell it? You know, I am in the firm belief, kind of, I guess, like you, I have not read your book, that the culpability is very wide in German society for the Holocaust, not just the bad guys. I think there's a wider culpability. And so I wanted to explore that, right? So that's what the Baker is doing there. And then that's why Nixon goes back, to see the villagers also coming firsthand with the crimes that they were part of. And Nixon goes back, I think, because, you know, he has heard that this is happening, that these camps are being cleaned up. And I think he just wants to go and sort of put a period in it himself, you know, his own sort of trying to understand what the fuck did he see, you know, and who are these people that did that? And he wants it from a character standpoint. He wants it ingrained, because I don't know if you notice, he turns down a Kleenex, you know, a handkerchief to keep the smell at bay. And again, remember, the episode is really about Nixon. So it has to end on Nixon. You know, Nixon has started the episode, if you take out the frames. You know, Nixon's in a place of really doubting, way more than some of the other guys, what the fuck he's doing there. And, you know, we first see Nixon, he's just come back from Operation Varsity, and which was not a successful mission. And he was, in fact, in a C-47 that blew up. And he was, in fact, one of two or three people who got out of there alive. And so those are also sort of like, what am I doing here? Why did those 20 guys die? You know? And so it's all part of a piece, you know, it's all one story in the end.
Well, and it's great too, because it's an individual allusion to Eisenhower's whole reaction to the Holocaust, which was basically, you know, I personally am going to go visit these places so that no one can ever say this didn't happen.
Right.
But also, you know, he made it kind of a policy, as you show with Taylor, you know, that
right,
we're going to put as many people through this, as well as, I think, in some ways, soldiers, too. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could see it, to see it, you know, so that it's much nicer to see a character do that, you know, than just to kind of have it as a general policy. Right. Which I think
there's no. It's again, it's just so beautifully directed. And also we cannot say enough about Michael Kamen, the composer who composed the whole show, which was not something that normally happens. Normally, like a big deal composer like Michael Kamen, who sadly died 5 or 7 years after Band, but he was at the top of his game when he made Band, one of the most in demand feature score writers in the business. And he also had an uncle or two, and he was Jewish, who served in the war, and he might have lost some people, he might have lost some family as well, Michael. And my point is, he wrote the whole music from beginning to end of Band of Brothers. Which again, normally doesn't happen. Normally, like, the big guy comes in and he writes the theme song, and then somebody else writes all the other music. But the music in episode 9 is really good. And, you know, it is part of the episode, and the music, as he's in that, because there's no dialogue when Nixon revisits the concentration camp. And for me, if you're a filmmaker, and you can convey a lot of information and a lot of emotion without any dialogue, oh, that's a good day. That is a good scene. And there's basically no dialogue in that last 2 minutes of him at the camp. And yet you as the audience know so many things that is being said without it being said, or being discussed thematically without us telling you what to think. And I think the music is a huge help in that sequence in particular. And then music is important to this episode because of the setup of
the violinist
Mozart
the beginning
versus Beethoven, and that's important for a couple of different reasons. But mostly it's because, you know, the culture that gave us Beethoven gave us the Holocaust, and what do we do with that as human beings? Like,
I mean, I was going to ask this about sort of your influences upon you of other films about the Holocaust, because one of the things that popped into my head immediately was the scene in Schindler's List during the ghetto clearance, where there's an SS guy playing the piano. And of course, at the same time, they're shooting people and everything else. And the two SS guys come in and they're leaning the door, and the guy's like, Beethoven. And the guy's like, no, Beethoven. I mean, and then Nixon does the same thing. Nixon corrects them at
Germany
the end.
Germany was an incredibly cultured country. You know,
yeah.
I mean, they took their conductors very, very seriously. Furt Wangler and Herbert von Karajan was actually a Nazi. And classical music was a huge part of German culture still in the 30s and the 40s. All the great, you know, I'm a huge classical music fan. So I wasn't I have to this day only seen Schindler's List one time, the one time I saw it in the movie theater. I do not love those kind of movies as an audience member. They're very hard on us, the audience, you know. So I have not revisited Schindler's List. So if there is that similarity, it would only be coincidental, you know, because I think thematically it is a weird thing, you know. Goethe, Beethoven, you know, this sort of these humanists, these really artistic humanists that really are at the birth of German culture and the Holocaust. I mean, it's like, how do these things, how do they exist in the same world, you know? And I guess to me, in some ways, the episode is, well, none of us are above the Holocaust, you know? I don't think it's explicitly stated in the episode, because I'm not sure that was where my head was when I wrote it, but I certainly think in the ensuing 20 years, you know, we can say, yeah, it doesn't really matter what culture you're a part of. We can all do really, really culturally bad things. And even this incredibly rich, liberal, artistic, self-aware culture, you know, the home of Freud and all these things, you know, the culture that created all this great Western thinking created the most evil, mechanized, killing process imaginable.
Yeah.
Are they part of the same? Can you have one without the other? I don't know.
Well, I mean, always questioned, like, yeah, you know, when I think about anything that pertains to exactly what we're talking about is, you know, and it was sort of asked by the veterans at the beginning of the show, you know, that whole thing of could we have been friends, and we probably could, because the thing that's always sort of spun my wheels a little was every person involved what you would call personified evil? You know, was there a soldier going home at night who was a good husband, a good father? Probably. A German soldier was vastly different from a Nazi soldier. You know, Nazism, when it came in, Germany had gone through, you know, a horrific downfall in their country. You know, they were burning, you know, money to stay warm at one point. There was no bread on the table. And then all of a sudden power came in. People started having food on the table. People started going on vacations again. Commerce had built back up. And there were these families, you know, going away on vacation. And did they know what was going on down the street? I'm pretty sure a lot of them did. And it was that thing of, do you speak up? And will you be vilified? Or do you, you know, what you don't look at doesn't hurt you? And I think, you know, I don't know if you've seen a Zone of Interest. You know, but that was the first film that I've seen, you know, where I've gone, oh, wow, they're really trying to show that, you know, a lot of these guys were what you would call normal men that were going out and doing unspeakable evil acts and then coming home and kissing their wife and taking their kids to school. I mean, it's just, you know, it's something that, and I think John sort of touched on that a lot with the old lady in the house, or young lady, I should say, I shouldn't call her old. But you know, that and the baker and everybody just keep to their lane. And if they don't look over here, then it's not happening, you know?
Well, I think the point you just made, Ross, it's super important. You know, I always say this when I'm teaching or talking to anybody, you know, is that 99% of Nazis are not psychologically abnormal human beings.
Right.
You know, right. They're not sociopaths. They don't lack the capability to empathize, et cetera. Yeah. They are, you know, psychologically normal people, right? They may be acculturized in different ways. And I think, you know, for me at least, and again, you know, I'm probably not the target audience for the episode, but, you know, I'm thinking that baker supplied bread to the concentration camp, guaranteed, to the Germans at least, to the guards. I mean, like, you're in a very small town with a small sub camp next door. Like, the guards lived in that town. You know, the town bought its stuff from that, or the camp bought its stuff from that town. I mean, even if you look at the company that built the ovens eventually for Auschwitz, it started out because they were a crematoria firm in the town where Buchenwald was. the camp. Right. So like, you know, the camp needed an oven and there it was. Right. So I'm thinking, you know, exactly right. And Webster's an interesting character in the whole episode, right? Because he's like, he's sort of like the educated guy. And he's, you know, he's screaming off the back of the truck in the beginning. The exact opposite to John's point, which is also valid about, you know, how cultured they are. But he's also like, you pathetic, servile scum, you know, and that's also, I think, in some ways setting up this dichotomy. Or maybe it's not a dichotomy, which is the larger, more important point, you know, is that there isn't necessarily anything ennobling about being artistic. You know, it doesn't mean you can't be a horrible person, exactly, or a horrible culture, you know, just because you did these things. It's not a pass, if that makes sense. And Ross, I wanted to ask a question because you mentioned this earlier. You know, what did some of the other actors do to sort of prepare? Because you said, you know, I'm not going to go to a camp yet. I'm not going to, you know, necessarily go into that sort of exhibition space. Did other people decide to do it differently, or?
I don't know, would be my quick answer. You need to ask them. I don't think so. You know, I don't think there was anybody, you know, disappearing over the weekend to, I think a lot of people also during that episode realized how pivotal it was for Liebgott's character. And so it was sort of left alone in a strange way. It was sort of like, you know, allowing me to go and find that. In a strange sense. So it was, everybody was affected, the same as I was when we were actually on, it's weird calling it a set, you know, because that's really what it was. They built a set, but I mean, it was just so realistic. It was a camp. And so, everybody had a very, very solemn, you know, few weeks having to deal with it.
And when you said that the director sort of filmed it with grace, like, what do you mean? Because for someone that's not in that environment, how does
what I'm saying is it's sort of what we're touching upon, like what John's saying about Schindler's List, where you're going in and it's just like, it's just, you know, it's hard hitting. Now, of course, episode 9 is hard hitting, but I've never seen anything like episode 9 when it comes to showing anything of the Holocaust, because it's dealt with, you know, again, it's easing you into something you're not sure you're about to see. Then, of course, it sucker punches you, but what it does is it makes you sit there and watch. So that's what I mean by handling it with grace. It's like this.
I also think it has the advantage, Ross, of, you know, Holocaust movies center around characters that are experiencing the Holocaust firsthand, right? Mm. I mean, they're in the Holocaust, sure. And that's not the case here, right?
Right.
The characters that we are watching and falling in love are observing the Holocaust, you know, and we are observing them observing the Holocaust, which I think also it is a form of grace in a artistic sense, in that it allows us to be really, 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 really devastated and moved, but one layer back from it, because again, we're participating in it with our characters as observers, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, this episode is not about the
Croatian that's bald, who is the only person who really talks to Winters, you know, explaining what the camp is, right? This is not about his Holocaust experience, you know, which is just a different narrative way to talk about the Holocaust, you know?
Well, and I think it's, again, as someone who, you know, I've watched a lot of Holocaust films, and I think what's interesting about this one too is that often, if ever, when liberators show up, they're sort of the end. Mm-hmm. That's you know, the end of the story.
Right.
And then the liberators show up. Even in the history itself, you know, even in survivor testimonies about the Holocaust, you know, they will often, and then the liberators show up. And we were liberated. And then that sort of draws a line under the entire experience.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that we've learned, and I think we learned even from what you told us today, is that, you know, liberation is a two-way street in the sense that it also impacts the people doing the liberating, you know, and is another form of sort of, again, sort of the psychological moral injury. And you see it what makes it, I think, particularly powerful in this sense is because we've been watching Band of Brothers for 7-8 episodes by this point, we know the people. And that, as you point out, then it makes the experience even more visceral, because we can imagine. I'm forgetting the entire time the name of the sergeant.
Randleman, like
the big country boy.
Randleman, Bull Randleman.
Yeah, Randleman. Yeah, like, there's that one shot of him
smoking
just sitting
cigar,
there, right? And you have this like giant guy who throughout the series
tower,
he's been a tower
of dependability, and just he can do anything. Bull can do anything, right?
Yeah, he gets through anything. He's the big tough guy. You know, water goes right off his back. And you know, again, I think it's also a great example of the writing and the directing, where you know, it's just that one shot for like a couple seconds of him just sitting there, like what do I do? Like, what is this?
And that's the difference. That's the difference between the show and anything else that has covered the Holocaust for me. And that goes back to where I say it lands gracefully for me, because it's not, you're not watching a guard shoot a prisoner. You know, we already know the horrors of the concentration camp. We know that as educated people. And what the show does so beautifully is it shows you how you would feel seeing that. And it's what, it just goes to what John's saying. Yeah. You're not seeing it from the Croatian or the Jewish prisoner's point of view. You're seeing it from our point of view. You're seeing it from the audience. You're going in and going, oh my God, this is not what I was. Oh my Lord. And then you can't take your eyes off it. I mean, that's the other thing. You can't look away from episode 9.
With your character, Levi, you get that too, because you get a very, you know, in case the audience had been asleep for the first 8 episodes, you know, you get that very clear, the very clear signification that you're Jewish, because you're like, I'm going to go back home and I'm going to have like a bunch of Jewish kids, you know, in Brooklyn, et cetera. So we know that.
Fight,
right?
At the beginning about being a Jew, of course. It's like, yeah, it's a whole thing throughout.
So we know that, right? So then that adds the moment for me that's, I think, is actually the most powerful in terms of Liebgott's Jewishness as a character experiencing liberating a camp, is the moment when you're told to tell them they have to go back in, right? Because that's a moment that absolutely happened in lots of different situations for all the reasons that the script shows, right? With the medical doctor that shows up. But it's that moment that we all know would be difficult for anybody. But it's particularly difficult for your character because it hits you in a place that's unique to you, or at least amongst most Easy Company people who aren't Jewish, right? That's one place it seems in the way that it's portrayed. You're taking it personally in a way that another person has to do that wouldn't be.
Of course, and that fell on Liebgott because he was a translator, right? So I mean, that could have gone to any other German speaking man in Easy, you know. But it fell on Liebgott, and that's why even before he's like, I can't tell them that. You're crazy. That's what it written. You've got to. Okay, here we go. You know, and just seeing the devastation. But yeah, just it's that. It just humanizes everything, I think, in that episode from that moment. Because you just see what it does to a soldier. You know, we're talking about Bull. We could talk about malarkey in the camp. You know, have you ever seen anything like this? No. You know, Webster, no. All the men just, what is this? What do we do with this? This is not, we don't know this. You know,
they don't
just
know how
that
to
confusion.
Process it.
Yeah.
Literally, you know, what is this place?
Yeah. What is it? How is it? How did this come to be? And who are they? And then we find out who they are. But that still doesn't make any sense. Why? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, this is a place where the script, I think, also does a good job, now that you mention it, right? Because when they're asking, what kind of a place is this? And the prisoner is kind of like, oh, it's a prison camp. And then the guy says, oh, are these people prisoners like criminals?
Yeah, Nixon. Right?
Because that's the only way that somebody who's unfamiliar can conceive of why you might be. Clearly, you must have done something to be put in this place.
One of my actually favorite lines in that scene is kind of a throwaway when he says, the woman's camp is down the rail.
Is it the next railroad stop?
Yeah, the next railroad stop. You know, that's where you go, oh, and it's almost a throwaway line, but it just has so much meaning, you know?
Because there's way more to this. It's like, this is not, because again, we're walking in, going right back to the beginning of our conversation, we're walking in going, is this the first thing? Is this the only thing that we know looks like this, right?
Right.
Oh, no. It starts and it starts and it starts and it's going to go on and on and on.
Yeah, and then there's the scene where, you know, Winters is explaining about Taylor and they found all of these camps. The Russians found bigger ones, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So then we have the context of the wider machine that the Nazis created.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's a really, I mean, it's almost, in addition, you wouldn't want to do this, but I mean, I could show that as a standalone, you know, episode about liberation, about the liberation experience.
Oh, I think
experience.
You totally could.
You know,
I think it is used that way in some
people do use it
instances.
That way, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite good there.
Although and again, I have to tell you, I get a lot of shit because of the sex scene in the beginning. So to lighten the show up for a second. So when we started to write this, when we started to work on this thing, all the writers, we called ourselves the Band of Writers. We became super tight. It was actually kind of weird because it wasn't a TV show in any way. The way we made it is not how you make a TV show, including in the writing department. Normally you have a writer's room and you all get together and I don't even know what that process is because I've never been part of it. In this show, there is no writer's room. Technically, we didn't have a head writer. We had Eric, who was the first writer and knew more than anybody else. But in the chain of command, he wasn't like my boss, you know? And we all become friends really, really quickly. And we all said, oh, yeah, we got to, you know, I hate that there's no sex in the, you know, these guys are getting laid all the time. We got to have sex in this thing. We've got to have sex. Okay, we all agreed we're going to write sex scenes. I was the only one who did that.
Well, and you actually did too. There was like an attempted sex scene.
Yes,
which
yeah,
is
yeah,
really
I
interesting
exactly.
too.
I did too. I did
at
too.
The beginning, you know, which is a whole nother. I mean, it plays
part
into
of
that
the
criminality
story.
Thing.
It was not gratuitous, actually. I bring it up only because I've heard complaints that people think about showing that school in high schools or whatever, and there's this fucking nude scene that they get all upset about. But
well, I think all the actors were just upset because none of us got that scene. You know,
yeah, exactly.
It was some new kid
Hardy, right?
Yeah, and you gave him the scene, and we're like, really, really, John, 9 months.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen your ass, Ross. It wasn't going to make it.
I was going to say, now is that a thing where you're like, I really want to do a sex scene, or
no?
No, it was originally, you know, but we talked about it. I didn't do it gratuitously. I did it to talk about fraternization and the idea.
Well, but also,
that,
it also does
we
a great
so
job
comfortable
of
with the Germans that we loved fucking them, you know, I mean, that
well, but
was
it,
happening
I think it also does a great job of highlighting Spears.
Oh, totally.
Because
yeah.
The guy walks in, he's like, I give a shit that you're having sex with a German.
Yeah.
I just, that's a great did you have
moment.
All my stuff that I'm looting?
I love
you know,
that
like,
moment. Yeah. It's just like, so well directed. It's so well directed.
So great.
And I love the Spears arc in this episode, actually. You know, it's just kind of there and it's always a little funky, you know? The lighter beat where he just kind of looks at the lighter and then throws it back to I can't remember if it's Percanti or Randleman.
I mean, he's one of those guys that again, this isn't necessarily related, but I mean, you know, he starts out with this allegation, we'll leave it at that, right? That he like murdered a bunch of
POWs.
It's
not an allegation though. It happened.
Yeah. So
I mean,
like
in the show it's an allegation. In reality, he killed those POWs.
Exactly. And so like you know, he's not a great guy. he's not a guy.
You've brought up a huge issue. I don't know what to do with that, actually, you know, because Spears is a great warrior and his post-war career is really interesting. And yet he killed a group of POWs, you know, yet what was he supposed to do with them? You know, what he was I don't know, it's very complicated. Ross, you want to help me out here?
Nope.
I mean, I'm only speaking professionally, and I you know, you can't kill prisoners. It's not a thing you can do.
No, you can't. And he's not the only one to have done it, by the way.
No.
In Easy
Company.
But
what's interesting is...
No, in Easy Company. There's a couple of things that...
But I suspect that the SS...
sugarcoat.
Killing an SS guy after Bastogne hits differently. I mean, it's still wrong, but then killing regular German soldiers, mm-hmm. you know, during the Normandy drop, right?
I'm just saying I don't know what to do with it, you know?
But I mean, it's you know, ultimately, right? It's again, it's a great part of the story because, you know, as I always say, I have an issue with the idea of the Greatest Generation as sort of a generic commentary, mm-hmm. right? Because I sort of feel like they were really, really great in some ways. And also they were a generation that has its own problems, just like every single generation does. Mm-hmm. Everyone likes to bag on the millennials, but, you know, like for the past 20 years that we were at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, those were the kids that were volunteering to go fight that fight too, right? Mm-hmm. So Spears, you know, Spears is a good example of that. You know, on the one hand, he's a complex character. And I suspect as both a writer and an actor, like you much prefer a complex character than sort of a person who's just 100%, you know,
true story.
In one direction.
Spears didn't have anything to do with the book or the show. He was alive, wouldn't talk to any of us, didn't talk to Stephen Ambrose. And was invited to the premiere in Normandy and came to the shock of everybody, especially the writers. And apparently he was not going to come. I don't know if you know this story, Ross. Do you know this?
I don't know.
Had told Dick he was not going to come to the premiere because he was worried about being arrested for war crimes.
Wow.
Whoa.
And, you know, Dick convinced him to come, and so he came. But he was worried about being arrested by the French.
Wow, I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was still, I remember in episode 10, there was a whole thing that we were going to do when Liefgott gets sent up to kill the commandant. And there was, the rumor was he was instructed to do so by Spears. Mm-hmm. And I think by that point, when 10 was getting shot, like whispers had already started, been happening of, did these things happen? Did they not? People are going to be upset. Are they not? And so we ixnayed the order coming from Spears. I mean, I think I say it in the scene, but we were certainly going to be exploring it beforehand. And it was decided, no, best just go do it. And we'll sort of allude to the fact that Spears gave you the order to do it. So, wow, it's a dark story.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, right?
We're all just kind of nodding and like shaking our heads. Yeah, I mean that's.
Oh.
Yeah. Well.
So there you go.
Yeah. Great. before I let you go, I promised John that I was not going to talk about Masters of the Air, so I'm not really. With the exception of just a moment, perhaps, mm-hmm. because the Holocaust does appear in this in the series, sort of briefly.
Have you watched the whole thing?
I'm up to date.
Okay,
so I'm up
some
to
people
episode.
Got advanced screenings because we do revisit it in episode.
Yeah,
nine,
no, I'm only up to
episode nine.
Yeah, okay, so I'm only up to basically where they pass in the night.
Yeah,
where there's the POWs are passing a train.
Yeah,
and you know, how does that play in? I mean, and why did you decide to write that in the way that you did?
Very much. Yeah. I mean, that was very intentional, obviously. Well, Masters of the Air, I mean, it's a whole nother topic and a whole different show about a lot.
And I promise we won't talk about it for very long.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's about a lot of different things than Band is about. But one of the things that we wanted to do was sort of, you know, again, create the why we fight element into the show. And, you know, what will happen as the show progresses is we see Nazi Germany from a POW's perspective. And for me, a Stalag is a metaphor for Nazi Germany. You know, it is a group of people in a cage being told what to do every single day by their Nazi bosses. And to me, that's Germany. You know, it's not just a Stalag. And so the POW's journey through Nazi Germany from episode 6 through 9 is all sort of a why we fight. It's all sort of a, this is the state these people have created, which includes these mysterious trains taking clearly civilians and women and children to very scary places. And again, just hinting at it, you know, we get a little bit more into it later in the show, but nothing, there's no dedicated episode like episode right. 9 of Band, because we already did it.
Yeah,
you know, like you know, some of the early reviews of Masters were very upset that it was not Band of Brothers in the Sky. And it's not Band of Brothers in the Sky. It's not about a company of soldiers that you get to know in basic training.
Because and it literally can't them. Be.
Well, they're all going to be dead
exactly.
by episode
yeah.
4.
Yeah.
So, but it wasn't. It's never meant to be Band of Brothers in the Sky. But my point is, so yes, we talk about the Holocaust because I think Robert Rosenthal, who's one of our main characters, has a really interesting arc vis-a-vis the Holocaust. And if I may, and I'm sorry, Ross, to talk about another show for a sec, but Rosie, for me, the two most amazing people I've ever written about are Dick Winters and Robert Rosenthal. And Rosie is to me kind of the anti-Winters. I sort of like to say that you couldn't name these two men more correctly as a screenwriter. Winters, cold dude, man.
Yeah.
An amazing dude, an amazing leader. I would not want to have been his son. And Rosie, happy, doesn't salute back. I would have loved to have been his son. And they were both these amazing heroic men. But Rosie's journey, and it's history, and I'm going to give you spoilers. Rosie's Jewish, grows up in Brooklyn, becomes a lawyer right before the war starts, joins up after Pearl Harbor, becomes a pilot, ends up flying thousands of hours in Texas as a gunnery school flight pilot, meaning he flew B-17s.
He's flying the targets.
Flying the targets or flying the ship that the shooters were in.
Right, okay, yeah.
I think that's what he was doing, actually. He was the base. But it gave him thousands of hours in this B-17 and an advantage over a lot of other pilots. So he goes over in September of 43 as a replacement pilot in the 100th Bomber Group. And he's Jewish, but that is not his reason for being in the war. And he's really a humanist. And he comes down to, he ends up, if you've seen episode 7, he re-ups. He's done. He's against unmistakable odds. He re-ups after doing his 25 missions. And
knowing it's going to be 30.
Yeah, he ends up flying 52. But the reason he re-upped, he says it in the show pretty much how he had said it in various documents. You know, it's not because he was Jewish and he wanted to, you know, to defeat anti-Semitism. It was that he was a human being and he wanted to, as he says, you know, when you see somebody beating up innocent people, you got to do something about it or you don't have a civilization. You know, and that was really what moved him and grounded him. And he ends up, I'm whether I should give anything away, but he ends up being shot down over Prussia, over Poland, and sees some of these camps. He's rescued by Soviets, by the Red Army, and he sees some of these camps too. And we have a lighter version of kind of what we see in Why We Fight. He comes back, and after the war, the job's not done. So he's a lawyer, and he volunteers to prosecute Nazis and gets on a boat to Hamburg in 1946, where he meets his future wife, who's also a lawyer, who has volunteered. They're married within 3 weeks, and they spend their honeymoon prosecuting Nazis.
As one does.
Together. Including Hermann Göring. He was on the prosecution of Hermann Göring. She was on the prosecution team of IG
Farben. Yeah.
Yeah. She was on that prosecution team. So it's sort of like Liebgott going one step further in that journey, you know?
Well, it's fascinating you mention that because for the last episode, the one that just came out for this podcast, I interviewed the director of the National Museum of American Military, Jewish American Military History in DC. And, you know, he had lots of stories of either people who had fled the Nazis and then enlisted and went back and fought them, or people who stayed on, you know, Jewish American soldiers who had liberated camps and then basically stayed on to work with displaced persons, for example.
Wow.
You know, mm-hmm. in the camps to help, you know, Jews get situated and get immigrated and those kinds of things. So it's really fascinating to find out that Rosenthal did that. And I must say, when I was watching the Masters of the Air episode, and again, I'm not your target audience, but the way I read it, which I think was actually really good in some ways, was a reminder that as bad as Stalag Luft 3 is,
oh yeah,
it's not a concentration camp in the sense of of a, you know, SS run predominantly Jewish. I mean, so I felt like that was really necessary because, you know, just the scale of awfulness, and again, the suffering Olympics
a problem for some of our younger filmmakers to understand that the Stalag was not a concentration camp. Well, can't I show the bad Germans, you know, doing this to Buck and Bucky? And I was like, no, you can't. They didn't do that. That's not how these people were treated. You know, it's a different, whole different ball of wax. So, yeah, I mean, we couldn't just leave the audience with the idea that Stalag Luft 3 was what it was like to be, you know, captured or imprisoned by Nazis, because it also depended on what country you were from. The Russians treated the Russian POWs were treated like almost like Jews, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, 2 million out of the 3 million die in the first 8 months of the war.
Yeah, but even the POWs, like, they had POW camps with Russians, and it was a whole different fucking ball of wax than the Germans and the Americans and the British and the French.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was watching the episode, and, you know, like, it's uncharitable, but I'm a Holocaust historian. So, you know, I was like, oh, no, they got your radio. Like, that's the...
Yeah, no,
that's,
exactly.
That's the bad thing that happened to you.
No, they were giving, you know, lectures. They would put on plays. They had the Luftbandsters that was in the script at one point. You know, they had big bands. They had, you know, listen, they were really fucking cold all the time. And they had very little food. I mean, it wasn't like it was a camp. Like,
absolutely.
Like summer camp. But it was nothing like, you know, Dachau or a slave labor camp or an execution camp.
Well, I think that's a great way to sort of to wrap up as well, because I think the Why We Fight question is even harder in some ways for the bomber people, because mm-hmm. they're never seeing. I mean, it's... Mm-hmm. It's terrifying, and I that has just reinforced your series it how terrifying and awful it was to do that job, but it's in some ways very detached mm-hmm. from, you know, you I don't want to suggest that there's satisfaction in killing anyone, but when you're in an infantry unit moving from point A to point B, you are making progress, you are removing the enemy, you are defeating the enemy, and it's all sort of visible and measurable. But when you're in a plane, it's almost a numbers game that you're not. It's hard to sort of be as viscerally sort of angry and
totally different.
Yeah.
Thing. Totally different thing.
Thank you guys so much. I want to close with our question that I normally ask everybody, which is, you know, what is one book on the Holocaust, any book that you have found influential or interesting, engaging, or you would recommend?
May I go first, Ross?
Sure.
When I started working on this project, Hanks asked me to read a book called The Germans War by Stargardt, I think is
Nicholas
his name.
Stargardt, yeah.
Yeah. And it's not specifically about the Holocaust, although it kind of is. And that one I found really, really informative and eye-opening. Basically, it's stating that he looked at just a ton of letters coming from the Eastern Front, but the Western Front too, where basically what you were saying is that, yeah, everybody knew this was going on because they would write about it. They would take pictures of it, send the pictures home, you know. And so that book is a lot about the where did this anti-Semitism come from? Was it baked into the German culture? And how prevalent was it during the war? Anyway, so I found it fascinating.
Mine would be A Man's Search for Meaning. I was actually gifted that book, and I thought it was, as well as thought-provoking and ultimately heartbreaking, a very important read, and a very easy read, I must say, in the sense of page count, not as, you know, in the sense of tone or situation. But, yeah, I would advise anybody to pick up that book and have a read.
Well, thank you. And for everyone else, thanks for listening. Please like and subscribe and all the good stuff and all the different places you can. John Orloff, Ross McCall, thank you guys so much for being on.
Pleasure.
Yep, our pleasure. Thank you so much.